I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to be with you. And what I wish to share with you today is a very personal experience that is by nature ineffable. It is really impossible to put in correct words. And it's personal in that, you know, I experienced it. It's subjective. But I hope that by sharing one person's experience, we can touch the hearts and comfort the souls of those who are around us. And if indeed we can do that, then that's a very great bounty to all of us involved in this. And we thank you for coming. I'm very pleased to come in memory of Adele Sampson. And this day happens to be the 22nd anniversary of my deepest near-death experience, which occurred at the age of 16. I was a normal 16-year-old occupied with football games and boys and cars and plans for college and whatnot, when suddenly one morning I woke up and I was swelling and getting terrible hives and whatnot, and I of course went to the doctor and had some allergy shots, and it came home, and my father was gone. It was just my mother and I in the house, and as we were sitting around having our dinner that evening, I began to feel as if I were being pulled away from this plane of existence. And it was a wonderful, relaxing, enticing feeling. But then I began to become aware that I perhaps was going to pass out, that meant something was going to happen physically. We had a friend join us for dinner, a high school friend of mine. And I started to stand to let them know that maybe I was going to pass out, and I immediately was on the floor. Now, some of the details I relate to you have been referred back to me by my mother, because during this time I was physically unconscious. So this part is filled in with the details from my mother and my neighbors and whatnot. But what happened at that point in time was they proceeded to carry me out to the car and load me into the car. And my consciousness, at this point in time, I was unconscious, and I only briefly had a consciousness of the car pulling away. We lived in a rural area at that time. We lived in the mountains of La Crescenta, which didn't even have a post office. The town didn't have a post office. And so they loaded me into the car, and they were going to drive me to the hospital, but neither my mother nor my friend knew how to give mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and they realized that I wasn't breathing. So they took me out of the car and down to the bottom of my driveway, which was a steep driveway, and laid me out on the sidewalk. My consciousness was only became aware at the point in time when I heard a very loud noise of the fire engine arising. And by that time, many of the neighbors had gathered around this body on the sidewalk, and my best friend from really elementary school was standing there calling to me, and she was calling, "Renee, don't die. Don't die, Renee." And I heard this, and it seemed as if it was in a foreign language, and finally I computed the meaning of the words "don't die," and I realized that somehow my life was in danger, and I realized that I had an obligation to fight for my life for the sake of my mother and for my friend, because she had such terror in her voice that it cut through to my heart, and I tried to fight desperately for my life and tried to keep myself going, but the battle became overwhelming, and at this point I just surrendered myself, my soul, to the power that brings us all into existence and gives us all life, knowing that this is the source of all life and this is the way of all things. I simply surrendered. This is the first phase of the experience now, this experience of peacefulness, going through the awareness of a dying process. And then, in an instant, now, from this point on, when I explain to you, please, I ask you to listen with your heart, because I think there's a part of our hearts that can hear what I have to say, and yet know that the words have to be wrong. So that when I use a word like see, I don't mean how we see in a physical body. When we see something in this world, we use a physical organ to perceive something separate from us. And there's a certain distance and separation. And when I use the word see or any other word that relates to anything physical from this point on, I have to ask you to listen with your heart and understand that we have no words to correctly describe this experience, because all of our words come from this plane of experience, which is a plane of experience that has time and space. And all of our words reflect that and reflect the way that we perceive this existence. All right. What happened then was that I perhaps leave out details that are important to others, but at this point in time, the firemen had been working on me and giving me mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and they had given me a great deal of oxygen, and this crowd was around me. My consciousness went into this state of very luxurious peacefulness, and then, like that, I became like a ball of light or energy in the midst of this crowd that was circling the body. And I became massively aware, unlike any other awareness that I had had during physical existence, because I was aware not really of myself. I was aware of everyone around me. I was aware of my mother and my neighbors and my friends and the firemen and what they were thinking and what they were feeling, what they were hoping and what they were praying. And this was such a pummeling input of emotion and information that I was at once overwhelmed and confused and rather disoriented. I followed their attention to something on the sidewalk, and I looked at this body on the sidewalk, and I looked at the curve of the wrist bone, and I recognized that, and I remember looking at it and thinking, that looks so much like my wrist bone. And then I became aware that thing on the body, on the sidewalk, that really, suddenly, what became a piece of meat to me was what I had identified as myself before. And I had no connection with this thing on the sidewalk other than I had been with it for a very long time. But it had nothing to do with me, because suddenly I was more a person than I had ever been. I was more conscious than I could ever be. I was free of the limitations of being a physical being. I looked at this body and I was repulsed by the grief and the tumult around it, and by the very idea that I had ever considered something physical to be my reality, to be a human reality. And with that, again, I like this, I bumped up, way up above some light wires. And from that point, I could watch everyone that was beneath me, but I was not as closely associated with them, so I was completely feeling everything that they were feeling. And I watched my mother and a boy come out of a house up the hill that I could not have seen physically. And I watched the firemen, and I was very sad. I was very sad for my mother. I was very sad for my friend who kept calling me. I was very sad for the child who had come out of the house and who would walk down and see this body. I was terrified that he would see this and think that this was really death, that this, the body was really not in great shape at that time. I looked like a third-degree burn victim just about, but because of the degree of swelling and the problems with the skin that the allergy had caused. So my concern was for them, and I spent my time observing them and calling to them that everything was as it should be, that everything was fine, that I was free, that I was peaceful, that it was wonderful, that I loved them, and that they loved me, and that that was a bond that, unlike physical bonds, could never be destroyed. You know, everything physical breaks down and goes through changes and goes through cycles and all of this. But this bond that I had with my mother and with my friends, this was a bond of love, and that was eternal. And I tried to communicate to them over and over again. And I realized that I had no mouth. I had no body, that they couldn't hear what I was saying to them, and that I would have to leave them in the same hands that I had left myself in the process of dying. And with that, I turned away, just sort of like a ball, just turning away. My attention turned away lovingly, but knowing that there was nothing that I could do, turned away from them and began to pull up. And I became aware, it was as if I were a camera on a spaceship or something, in a sense. I became aware of our place, my particular little street, and then my particular little town. And then I kept pulling up and pulling up and pulling up to a point where I could observe the whole earth. And this was wonderful, because the earth was alive, and the earth was singing, and it was singing a single song, and in that song, everyone had a voice. Every human being had a very important note to add to this precious song of the earth, and it was a song of love, and every living being had something to add to the song of earth, and every one of these essences was very much connected. I was seeing it not like we see normally. I was seeing it both from a macroscopic, which means a viewpoint of like a spaceship, and a microscopic vantage point. Microscopic in that I could see that the amoeba in the ocean was connected to the song of the heart of all humanity, and that this world was responding to the song in our hearts in a miraculous, unified, and beautiful way. And I, too, began to sing. I was so overcome with joy. It wasn't a song, obviously, with a mouth. I had no mouth. I had no body. I simply was. But I became a part of that song in very full of joy that I could have something to contribute to this sacred beauty of our earth and our planet and of all people. So I became very aware that we as human beings have unique influence on the world. Even if we're not actively doing something, we influence this planet by our state of being. We influence this planet very positively, if we're filled with love and respect for others, and we can influence it negatively if our hearts are negative. From this point, I became aware that there was a light calling me from somewhere else. And I entered what people speak of as the tunnel. I'll speak of it as that, although I didn't quite perceive it as a tunnel. It was a transition place where I became aware of other beings that seemed to be rather disoriented and confused and lost, and other beings that were moving through to their home. I simply wanted to go home. I moved through this place and I became aware that I was not moving like we move physically. When we move physically, we have an intent, we have a goal, and we proceed step by step to that goal. There's no way for me to get from here to there other than taking one step and another step and another step. But what moved me through this place, where I was aware of people who were not moving through and somewhat confused, what moved me through this place was love. And it was the love of God for, it was the love of love and the love of all things sacred and all things beautiful and all things just, and I could go on and on and on, but this was what propelled me, was my connection and my affection for God. As I came to the end of this place, I wondered if I would be alone, and then like that, instantly, I was one with my uncle, just like we were two lights that had gone together, red and blue light and made purple light. And I was aware of things about him that I had never been aware of in life. I didn't spend much time with him. I didn't know him well because he lived in the South and I lived in California. But it was a very joyful reunion. And I became aware that he was concerned that I was there because he communicated to me just instantaneously that my mother couldn't stand the loss of a child. And he was confused, but at the same time he knew that everything was as it should be. There was just tremendous feeling. From that point, I became very attracted to the light. And this attraction was like an irresistible magnet. I loved my uncle, and I can go into detail on this later if you wish. I loved my uncle dearly, but more than this, I loved the light. I loved what was pulling me home. And I moved past my uncle into what I can best define as a sea of light. And it was as if every atom in the universe had been electrified with color and light and sound, but more than that, with totally unconditional love. And it was a welcoming to me, and I dove into this ocean with each moment, with each movement, feeling more rapture and more joy and more just absolutely unspeakable love. As I moved through the sea, I became aware that I was moving to the center of the sea of light, which I perceived to be, how could I say it, if you were a gnat and you were flying into the sun, that's the perspective that I had moving through the sea of light. And then in an instant, again, like a clap, I entered into this light, and I became one with this light and of this light, and no longer an individual, no longer a person, but simply a part of this light. I became like a phoenix. I was destroyed, and it was the most blissful, the most excruciatingly beautiful moment that I could imagine. It seemed to me to be the apex of all existence, to get to the point to where one was no more. One simply, you know, was a part of this light. After being in this state for what seemed to be a time beyond time, I was gathered again together like sands from the shore as an individual. And I was called to recount for my deeds. This part of the experience, of the near-death experience, I think is usually only common to people, although it does happen occasionally, common to people who've had deeper experiences where they have a time of their life review. And what it consists of, again, depends upon the individual. And what it was a time in which I viewed the events of my life in a totally different perspective. And I didn't view them, again, like we view things here, where there's a separation between myself with the eyes and what's happening over here. I viewed them as if I were reliving my own life with a knowledge that I could never have had before, of all the psychological complexities of myself and everyone that I came into contact with. And I relived not just my life, but I relived the effects of my choices, of my actions, upon other individuals. So in other words, if I did something like throwing a stone into water, this was what it was like. My actions were like throwing a stone into water, and they caused reverberations throughout the world. So if I did something kind to a person, just simply kind, with no expectation of reward, this was wonderful, and it seemed to reverberate through the pond of life from one person to another person to another person. If I had given a person some kindness, and that person went on to perhaps be more patient with someone else, or to went on to share kindness with someone else, there was a wonderful effect that I felt. And again, if I had done something cruel, I think it would have been absolutely devastating. But if I had done something where there was no particular motivation of my heart, where there was no pure motivation, it was as if I had done nothing at all. So in this context, what became meaningful was not how people saw me, not how we measure ourselves in terms of society, but what became very meaningful were my motivation for action and my sincerity and the depth of my good feeling for others, and whether or not these actions brought benefit to other beings. And if anything I had ever done brought a benefit, then this was wonderful. And I remember one of my most glorious actions was something I would never have remembered that I having done. I had done things in school. I had been an excellent student, and I had received awards, and I had done things like that. But all of those things were meaningless. I had known some important people. I guess I looked okay. All the ways that we judge people here in this life were meaningless. But what was meaningful was to take an action that was filled with love or kindness, with no thought of reward, and to share that action with another individual. So one of the most glorious things I remember in the context of this was simply, I used to work with retarded children. When I was a teenager, every summer we had a camp for retarded children. And I had a child in one of my summer camps that was not particularly attractive, that was not particularly well-liked, that was not a charming child at all. But one day I felt a tremendous sense of love for this child, and felt that this child should know that he's loved. Even though he cannot communicate, he'll never be an important person in terms of the world, that this child should know, just experience the love. So I took him aside one day and spent some time with him and gave him water to drink on a hot day. And this was one of the most meaningful things I could have done with my life. I could have been president of the United States, I think, and it wouldn't have compared to that particular action. So it gave me a new way of understanding my life and the lives of other people, and the importance of people, because quite often the people in the context of this life review, the people that were important were the people that are not important in this world, and they were very meaningful in looking at my life in that context. From this point, I became aware that I had been accompanied by a presence during this, and my consciousness, not my body, of course, but my consciousness turned to him, and I could not focus on him because he seemed as if strictly all light. It just was this wonderful, loving, beautiful, exquisite presence with me. I turned to him, and he escorted me to see the state of the world, and I knew that this was because I had for many years carried a great concern about the state of the world. This was a concern of my heart. It wasn't a concern of my mind. It was something that perplexed me throughout my life. And I'm not the only person to report what I'm going to explain to you. I know another gentleman who had, I believe it was a car accident, I don't recall, who had a very lengthy clinical death, who went through something almost exactly what I will now relate to you. What this was an answering of a question of my heart that I had carried with my soul throughout my life, and that was, where are we as humankind? Where are we going? What's happening? I've been a child who had had bomb drills in school and was very conscious of the fact that we were capable of destroying ourselves in an instant. I remember my parents, I had been a sickly child, and I remember my parents discussing, well, if they dropped the bomb, how would we get out? You know, would we go over the mountains, or would we go around, and who would carry me, and whatnot. So it was very much a part of my reality, this concern for the world. And I watched as mankind went through stages of growth and evolution, spiritual, social, and intellectual development. And I did not watch as one would watch a television show. I watched as one would re-experience life in an age. So it was just as if I were a Neanderthal and feeling that level of consciousness and watching what was going on around me, and then watching as mankind went through different stages of development, moved into the Roman age, and felt the politicality, I guess is the best word, the manipulation of that particular time, and then went through the scientific revolution and the Renaissance, and became aware of the importance of rationality for human beings, and then moved into my time. And I knew it was my time because, again, I got a glimpse of this body on the sidewalk. It was as if I were given a point of reference to say, this is where we are. And I became aware that the world was at a very great turning point, that we all, as human beings, as the human race, existed at a very great point in our development where we had to learn to live together. We had to learn how to have peace, and not just peace on a simple political level, but learn how to have true peace between individuals and different cultures and all the different types of humanity that we have on this planet. And that this was the greatest choice that mankind had ever faced, that we were at the greatest step in our evolution that we had ever faced, and that this was the step where we would become truly human, truly spiritual beings on the face of the earth. And this new people I called the Just. That was the title that I became aware of. And this new people was working together to create a new civilization. And they were doing small things, just like people do, cooking and organizing and helping others and whatnot. But in so doing, they were creating a new civilization. And this was the hope for mankind. And I saw then, in connection with this hope, a wonderful building in which men and women were equal, and which gave new direction and new laws and new ways to have peace and growth on this planet. And it was a beautiful white building set on a hill that overlooked the ocean, and it was on the Mediterranean, and it was in an old place and yet in a new place. I had never seen this building before, but it was the hope, I knew, of the Just, this people. And I knew if I ever were to come back to this life, I would have to find those people somehow. I would have to find that particular group, because they were the only ones that were, for me, they were the only ones that were bringing people together in a time where I saw that every religion was fighting every other religion, that people became terribly polarized, that people became very conscious of different races and very conscious of different political beliefs and very conscious of anything that divides us. And they hung on to those differences passionately. They became all-consuming, important things. And at the same time, there was this group of people that was building a new civilization. I also became aware that because of the extreme polarization of the earth, there were disturbances in, now it doesn't sound like news, in 1967, when I tried to bring all of this into this world for the first time, this wasn't, but there were disturbances in the order of things and weather patterns and whatnot, and there were great disturbances on the face of the earth. And it was the result of our state of being. Each one of us is a creative being that contributes to the song of this earth and has tremendous influence by our state of being. And I had spent 3 years praying to come back into the presence of this being of life. And he was the blessed beauty. And he was the light of God. I didn't understand what those things meant intellectually. I want you to know that. But I understood that that was his station. And as I had before in my dream, once I became aware of his existence, I simply wanted to die. Of course, that was sort of redundant given the state of my existence at that point. I simply wanted to cease existing and simply be in that presence. And I was for a time beyond time. He, as he had before, turned to me and took on a beautiful form, and he extended his hands to me and he said, "Here am I, here am I." And with that, I simply was in a state of ecstasy and joy and great surrender, and yet was not as an individual, as a self. That seemed to be for time beyond time. It seemed to be for an eternity, but it obviously was not. And then I was outside of this presence and looking at another world where there were people working and where there were people that I knew intimately, as well as I would know my own father or my mother, and that I loved as dearly, and that I was as happy to see. And these people were working and very much involved in the life of this world. And there was a gentleman welcoming me into this world. There was a river that had to be crossed. And as I propelled myself by my attraction towards this man, the light spoke, and it said, not in words like we know, it was rather like the word. There was absolute authority to these words. And it said, it is not time. And I froze in existence there. And I knew immediately that I was frozen there as a mercy, as a comfort, as a protection. And again it said, it is not time, a second time. And with that, I was catapulted back down what I did perceive to be a tunnel this time, down a rainbow tunnel of light and sound and vibrational frequency of love, really. That's what it felt like, down this rainbow tunnel. And then with a terrible, hard crash, I became aware of the scene that I had left earlier, with the fire trucks, and now an ambulance had arrived, and there were men who were picking up the body and loading it into the ambulance. And I was in a state of complete grief. I felt like I had become Eve and was cast out of the Garden of Eden as I was descending down this tunnel. My heart was always attached to my home beyond, and I was begging not to leave, but I crashed down into this plane of existence and was suddenly confused by time and space. It was as if I had never existed physically, and I was suddenly disoriented. And I watched them pick up the body and load it into the ambulance. And I was accompanied by other beings who were almost undefined. I became aware of them in that they were pushing me in certain directions, but they were not easy to focus on. And I watched as the ambulance then drove to the hospital. And then for a brief moment, they got a heartbeat in the ambulance. It was a rather long drive to the hospital. They got a heartbeat in the ambulance. And for me, that was a terrible, pain-drenched moment. And then I popped out again above the ambulance. And my concern for my mother, because she was by herself, she was visiting a 16-year-old daughter, and she knew that this was happening because the ambulance attendant looked to the driver in front the second time when he lost the heartbeat and said, DOA, DOA, which of course means dead on arrival. And the driver turned off the siren and slowed down the ambulance, whereas before he had been driving in a very reckless manner. We were coming out of the hills. And as he did that, my concern was for the pain of my mother. I simply wanted to comfort her, to wrap my soul around her, and to assuage the loss of a daughter, the loss of a child, and found myself simply praying for her. Now, I found the ambulance to the hospital, and I watched as the body was unloaded, and my mother followed the gurney into the emergency room. And I watched as the first doctor went to work on me. I wasn't particularly interested, however, in the first doctor, because the first doctor had that day been through motorcycle accidents coming out of the mountains, and he had been through a very long day, and he was not concerned with someone who was already brought in dead on arrival. And he had no connection to me. He didn't care. He had no affection. So I had no interest particularly in watching what he did, because my interest was based upon affection and love. And I then left the emergency room and went and was above my mother and was above some friends who had followed her in another room and again tried to communicate with them. I tried to let them know that they should be, my friends especially, not my mother. It was too difficult. But with my friends, that this was a very joyous occasion, and that I was dead on arrival, and that hopefully all would go well, and they would never be able to revive me, and I was going to be dead now. Now, all of a sudden, death became life to me. Death was not something to be frightened of, but rather something to look forward to. What happened then was the first doctor did pronounce me dead and was sending the body off to the morgue. When my own personal physician, who was a country doctor and a very gruff man, came into the emergency room in a tuxedo with his black bag. He stormed in and he looked at the nurse on the phone who was calling the morgue, and looked at the doctor who was washing his hands, and looked at the body, and he said, "What the hell happened here?" And he said, "Where the hell is the patient?" And they said, "Well, she was dead on arrival, and that's it." And he said, "The hell she was!" And he proceeded to scream at the other nurse who was sort of standing off in the corner, "I want injections of adrenaline. And I want, you know, bring them to me immediately and come over here and assist me." And he began to go to work on the body. He began to beat on the chest. I was simply terrified by this turn of events and disgusted that they would treat a body so brutally. All of a sudden I sort of became protective of my body. Even though I wanted nothing to do with it, they could at least be nice about it. But they were beating on the chest and shocking the body, and I was up in the corner of the emergency room, accompanied by other essences who were sort of keeping me now contained in that emergency room. And this seemed to go on for a very long time, until my doctor finally stopped and asked if there was a cardiologist on duty. And they said, "There's no cardiologist on duty." And I heard my doctor, thinking about injecting my heart with adrenaline. And this is something I had never heard of before. It seemed a barbaric and brutal and appalling view, and I was just repulsed by the very idea. But there was no cardiologist on duty. My doctor, again, was swearing at the nurses that should happen, and decided one more time that they would try. He said they would give up to 6 shots of adrenaline. Now, the other doctor started arguing with my doctor, saying that this was a dangerous thing to do, you know, to try and bring me back now, because there could be brain damage and I was brought in dead on arrival, and it was best not to do that, and that he could do terrible damage to his patient by proceeding on trying to revive me. My doctor looked at him and said, well, what the hell, she can't be in any worse shape than she is now. one more round. And it was the last round that did indeed bring me back. And for my consciousness, for me, it was a very terrible thing that these doctors were now succeeding in bringing me back. This was the most terrifying thing I could imagine, was having to come back to this life, to a world that lacks love, to a world that people consider real and yet is not real, is not the lasting reality, and to a world that is, seemed to me, would forever be absent of the light. What happened was they did manage to bring me back in my consciousness like this, in a very dark, painful moment, entered through the crown of the head, and they at that point had life signs. I was still unconscious, however, until I awakened in the hospital room some hours later. I'm not sure how many hours later. But I came to in the hospital room, and at first I could see that there was light around me, and I felt comforted by this light. But then I became aware that I was here and that I was in a physical body and that I was now going to have to face this life. And I began to grieve at the prospect of facing life. I began to cry just as one would cry, losing a loved one. I felt a great sense of terrible loss to be on this plane of existence, and to be separate from what I would always know from this point on to be my home. Well, my mother came in and she saw me crying, and for a moment I considered the idea of suicide, that it seemed totally contrary to the sense of purpose and sacredness of all life that I had felt, and the sense of love. And my mother came in and saw me crying and simply responded to me when I said I was dead wrong. She said, I know you were dead, Renee. And we hugged, and I simply cried for days over this. At this point, I had to deal with the medical community. My doctor, who was a very little short, spicy, ornery man with not a particularly charming manner about him, came into my hotel, into the hospital room, and asked me, what did I do to myself? What in the world could I have done to myself to bring this about? And I said, well, you know, I did nothing, but you had no right. You had no right to bring me back. And I was screaming at him. I was so angry. And he, of course, did not understand, because in his eyes, he had done a terrific and wonderful thing, and he could not imagine a patient screaming like that and being so angry. And he said, what do you mean I had no right to bring you back? And I said, I was dead. I was dead, you know. And he said, well, you weren't dead, because you're not dead now. And I kind of sat back and shook my head, and I realized that, well, if that's one's definition of death, and that's true, but I was dead, as far as I was concerned. And I told him that. I said, I was dead, and you know I was dead, and I did not want to come back. And he, at that point, proceeded to send out for the psychiatrist. Now, this psychiatrist was a lovely lady who really honestly thought that I was a terribly disturbed patient and perhaps in danger of committing suicide. So she was taking this very seriously. And she told me that her role as a psychiatrist has to be first and foremost to protect someone. And if she thought I was suicidal, then she would have to put me away. Given the fact that what my doctor had told her, she would have to conclude that. So I would have to convince her that what happened to me, whatever it was real. And I said, I can't convince you. I can't even talk about this. There's no words. And she sat in the room and I cried. And she sat in the room and I cried. I said, there's no way I can communicate this to you. How can a person communicate incomprehensible, limitless, unconditional love and rapture? How can a person communicate the sacredness of all things and the beauty of all spirits and the sanctity of all life? How can a person communicate those things? Finally, I began speaking to her like this. And she sat and she listened. This was a very long time. And finally, she would ask me little questions. And she would ask me questions about what transpired in the emergency room. You know, what did this doctor do? What did that doctor do? And these were not things that I particularly considered even interesting or important. But to the scientific community, they were very interesting and important. But what she did was listen to me, and she stood up and she said, well, I'm going to investigate this, and I'll come back to you. And she went down and she checked out the details, and she came back to me. And she said, well, you were right. You're not crazy. You were dead. And she said, and you were right about all the things that you told me about the number of injections of adrenaline and that doctor looking for the cardiologist and the first doctor having a, you know, motorcycle accident before and all of the details that I related to her. And she said, Anne, you were right about what you communicated to me about any sane person would react with grief after having experienced what you did, and then find yourself in a world where people compete, where people are full of hostility, where people lack love and respect for one another for all sorts of reasons having to do with, you know, crazy things like race and politics and those kind of things. She said, you were right to feel these things. And this was a real experience. And I said, well, now what do I do? She said, whatever you do. She told me at that time that there was someone who was doing research on this and that there was some documented cases of things beginning to happen. I believe it was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And she said, well, perhaps you should turn now to your religion for some answer, because I, as a psychologist, can't give you any answers. And I said, what can I do? I don't think I can go back to the religion that I had before. She said, well, try and talk to, you know, a minister about this or a father and see what you can do. I said, I didn't feel comfortable with that. And then she said, well, if you can't talk to one of those, she said, then the best thing for you to do is to, you know, learn to deal with it yourself. Learn to deal with this experience. But never, she said, never in your life should you ever, not to a psychologist or another doctor or another individual, never, she said, should you speak about this experience again? Because she said this is too difficult for people to handle with their what the world is that exists now, and it will then become too difficult for you if you share this experience. Well, obviously I did not take the woman's advice, but I think that these experiences are important because they give us a perspective on life. This was simply one person's experience, but they tell us, they teach us that perhaps there is a reality that is not confined to time and space. Perhaps we as human beings are not what we think we are. Perhaps we're not the way that others judge us. Perhaps we are something very precious and something very sacred and something very special. We are spiritual beings. These near-death experiences have helped people in the scientific community deal with the idea of a spiritual reality of the human being. And if we are a spirit, if our true reality is something that is not physical, something that is not composed of physical elements, is something that will not decompose, then what is this composed of? These were the questions that I was left to deal with, not the question of what are we, because I knew very much now that we are spiritual beings, and that this was our essential and our important reality. But I was left with the question of where do I find my connection with the light in this world? Where do I find the way to work with those people, the just, that I had seen? Where do I find my role in this life? I felt I could not exist without a connection to that blessed beauty that I had seen. Okay, can we take a break now? I think what I would like to do is take a few minutes break and then come back and discuss with you the meaning of the near-death experience as far as I was concerned, and then talk about your questions and answers, your questions, if you should have any. And we'll go from there. Oh, well, thank you for all these wonderful questions. This is probably very, very common. How long did the experience last? Every time I speak somewhere, someone asks, how long did the experience last? Well, the experience lasted what seemed to be, for me, an eternity. Time-wise, if a person were measuring on the clock, it was anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes, I think the best thing for me to do is to leave it there. It had to be a minimum of 20 minutes and probably more like 30 minutes, maybe up to 40. I'm not exactly sure. When I did one of the television shows, they went back and did some research with the fire department. They actually still had records, which surprised me. And it looks like the best estimate of time that we can come up with is about 30 to 40 minutes. What do I think of suicide? A friend of mine committed suicide 3.5 weeks ago. What do I think of suicide, and where do these people go? Was the person who asked that question? Well, never mind. She did? Okay. I think that suicide is a great tragedy. I think it's very understandable given what some of us have to suffer in this life. But for myself, I've had no shortage of physical suffering in this life since my near-death experience, that I personally feel that, that life is very sacred, and that it's a gift of God or the Great Spirit, so therefore I must cherish it. That I believe that God alone can deal with these things such as suicide, and I think that we as individuals, as people who love those people who have perhaps gone into the next world as a result of that, we can pray for those people and pray for their progress in the next world, and they also will likewise pray for us. One of the things I was very aware of in the near-death experience was the absolute connection between those of us in this world and individuals who are no longer in the physical realm of existence. That there is no real separation. The only separation that there is separation that we sense because of time and space. That we're only in time and space for the period of our lives, and there's an eternal reality that exists beyond that. So we can, through prayer, help those that we know who have gone on and help to comfort those people. And likewise, they can help to comfort us. Most near-death experiences, this is very interesting, there's been a lot of different studies done on them, and in general, on suicidal people, if people say they're interested in committing suicide, or proclaim that they wish to commit suicide, a given percentage of those people will, and it's very predictable. I believe it's like 15% or something like that. But if those people have a near-death experience as a result of the suicide, and then come back into this life, they don't attempt suicide ever again. So some people would think that to hear me speak about death and whatnot, that this is a wonderful thing and whatnot. Well, common to near-death experiencers is a sense of the sacredness and the sanctity of all life, and that as long as we have it, we must respect the love and the spirit that gave us that life. But also common to near-death experiences is a sense that there's a great ocean of mercy and compassion for all of us in all of the troubles that we go through. Okay, do I remember things about my uncle that he told me about myself? That he told you about himself that you didn't know before? Well, my uncle, it's funny, it was not a telling. You know, in this world, we communicate mostly through talking to each other. But it was not a telling, it was a union of my uncle and myself, so that I became aware of his essence, of his spiritual essence. And one of the things that I became aware of in his spiritual reality was that he was a man of great courage. If you saw this man, you would see him as being a very tall, stoic, gentle man, very quiet and reserved. But there was in his character, in his spirit, a great element of courage that I had never been aware of in this life. How he had stood up for things he had believed in and expressed that courage so that it became a part of his spiritual reality. This was, again, not communicated to me. It was simply an awareness of my uncle that was instantaneously complete. That's one of the things that makes it very difficult to communicate about the near-death experience, is that, as I explained before, in this world, if we want to get from here to there, we have to progress through all the different points, and it takes us a certain amount of time. Whereas in the next world, we are propelled by our attraction, by our love. We have a hidden word in the Baha'i writing, and it is loves me. This is Baha'u'llah speaking with the voice of God. It says, love me that I may love thee. If thou lovest me not, my love can in no wise reach thee. Here's a question. Were you able to communicate on a feeling level with your mother when you were outside your body? This is interesting. Occasionally my mother will travel with me to meetings such as this when I speak. And in one of these meetings we actually met a couple whose daughter had died at the hospital where I was, and whose parents had stood in the same, outside the same doors that my mother had stood outside, and it was very interesting that I was able to communicate to my mother, but she was so filled with grief that she couldn't fully perceive my communication. So I was hovering, you might say, above my mother, praying for her, telling her I loved her, telling her that everything was as it should be, telling her not to grieve, that it wasn't the way that we can communicate here. My mother would have had to be in a different state. We're blocked in our physical existence from being completely aware of those who are always around us, really, who never leave us. But my mother did say that when she was standing outside these emergency room doors, it was really not the emergency room, they put her in a hallway out that was a different hallway, but she did feel that I was with her, and she did feel that I wanted her to have comfort. But, you know, part of her was thinking about this, no, that wasn't true. Who were the essences or beings with you in the emergency room? I don't know. They had a wonderful sense of humor, however. they were a lot of fun in that sense, because there was a sense of great mirth and laughter. For instance, when my doctor came into the emergency room and said, you know, where the hell is the patient, when it was no secret that there was a body lying right there. And when he made comments to the other doctor that I couldn't possibly be in much worse shape than I already was, there was a great deal of sense, not laughter, because these were spiritual essences and not physical beings. There was a great sense of mirth and joy and humor. And at one point during the ride to the hospital in the ambulance, I was outside of the ambulance, going down the road very fast with it, this spirit being traveling with this ambulance. And I remember thinking how funny that was, that this is ridiculous, that here I was outside the ambulance racing down the road. And I remember making a joke out of that maybe this is what happens to people who can never shut their mouth in this life, who are always speaking up, you know, for something or against something, that you're confined to this state of existence. And that was a very big spiritual joke amongst myself and the others who were accompanying me. So, who are they? I don't know. I think that we're always surrounded by those who are like us and those who love us. I believe very much as a Baha'i that there's no separation between the spirit world and the physical world in the absolute sense. Obviously, there's a separation. When my father died, we buried him, and I could no longer call him on the phone and talk to him. I could no longer ask him to fix things that he had always fixed before. But by the same token, we are very much connected to a spiritual reality, and the true reality there is love. What do I make of the souls that were wandering confused when I went directly towards the light. Do you think that those souls were not spiritual beings on earth and had a hard time progressing through to the spiritual world? This is a very interesting question. Do I think that they are not spiritual beings? I don't. My impression was that there were a number of things going on, that perhaps those people were in shock, that perhaps they were confused because of suicide. I think that really what I felt was that we need to be connected in this life to God or to the Spirit. We need to be connected to the light. We need to connect ourselves to that beauty. And the way that we do that is through faith and through the love of God. I read to you earlier one of the hidden words of Baha'u'llah, love me that I may love thee. And that God is telling us that we have to make the choice to love God. We have to pick up, you might say, the phone, the connection between our hearts and God. We have to love God, and through that love of God, we find our way in this world. Do I think that those souls were not and had a hard time? Yes, I believe that they were having a harder time progressing to the spiritual world because they lacked this connection and this love of God. For me, how can our prayers for the departed get their assistance? Is this the door? Yes, it is the door. get their assistance. Our prayers to, I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. Is it to the departed or for the departed? I believe that we can say prayers for the departed. We as Baha'is say our prayers. We are required to say one prayer a day. I think many Baha'is say many, many prayers a day, and usually at least three times a day we will formally say prayers. And we are advised to pray for those who are deceased, and in that way we can reestablish our connection with them. It is the door. We feel a spiritual bond is the result of these prayers, and those people, we believe, help us progress in this world by their prayers, those of us who are in the physical world, and we help them progress in the next world through our prayers. So, as a Baha'i, I will always close my daily prayers with a prayer for my mother and a prayer for my father, because this is my duty to my parents, I believe, is to pray for them, especially my father now that he's gone on into the next world. Are the just an organized group of people or a collection of individuals working throughout the world in everyday capacities? These are big questions. Okay. That's one of the questions. The just. What is it? I haven't spoken much about the Baha'i faith, but immediately after my experience, I knew that I had to reconnect with the Baha'i faith. My family was very much against it, which is why I had never become a Baha'i, and I had only been to one fireside, after which I had the dream of the Blessed Beauty. And with the near-death experience, I felt that the only way I could maintain my sanity was to connect again with this blessed beauty. And somehow that had to do with the Baha'i faith. Well, Baha'u'llah is the manifestation of God that we Baha'is believe brought the teachings for the world in this day. We believe that this is a new age and that mankind has to make choices to either recognize or to deny this new manifestation of God. And the Blessed Beauty, I found out years later, is a title for Baha'u'llah. It's a title like Christ is a title for Jesus. I didn't know that. I had very little exposure to the Baha'i faith other than the fact that I felt this tremendous attraction. Are the just. So are we a group, the just are, to me, a Baha'i, the Baha'i. In the context of my experience, I knew that I could be able to decipher who the just were, not only by their actions, but by the fact that they would be the only organized religious group that would not be involved in warfare at this point in time on the earth, that would not be involved in shedding blood of other individuals because of their religious beliefs. Some years ago, I had the great fortune to travel to Israel to visit the Baha'i Shrines on Mount Carmel. I had only felt that this near-death experience was just very personal. I never really thought to apply it too much to this world. But in climbing up Mount Carmel and walking around, I came upon a building that was under construction, and I was simply overcome at that point in time with tears, and I was so moved to realize that what I had seen had actually become a physical reality. I'd seen it in 1968, and this was in 1980, and what I had seen was the building that houses the Universal House of Justice. Now, the Baha'i teachings center around the oneness of mankind, that there is one God. There always has been one God who has sent many teachers to many different people, but that this is a new age in which we must establish peace. And the Baha'i teachings inform us how we can do that on an individual level and on a collective level. There are new teachings, but there are the old teachings also. It's the same spirit, the same sun that has risen again, as promised in all the holy books. But we've always had to work to establish things in this world. We've always had to work to be just people and to bring about righteousness. Anyway, back to Israel. In Hathi at Mount Carmel, I saw this building under construction. I don't know if you can see it, that white building, which is, do you see this white building right here, the big one? It houses the Universal House of Justice, which is the elected Baha'i body for the whole world of the Baha'i community, for the international Baha'i community. So this is my connection with the light and with the just was to work at being a Baha'i and to hopefully with my life bring comfort and peace into the world with a pure heart. Okay, what is the purpose of our experience in the earth plane, and why must we go through our experience in this particular
dimension.
In this particular dimension. This is a very hard question, but let me address it. After this, I very much addressed the Baha'i writings. We have a great body of writings. And this is a question that I repeatedly had to deal with, being a person with several genetic problems that resulted in a lot of pain, I kept saying, why am I here? You know, what is the purpose of being on this plane of existence? What is it? Why can't we simply love God instantly? Well, God tells us in our writings, in the Baha'i writings, in the Bible, that we are made in the image of God. And what is that image of God? Is that a physical image? Everything physical, you know, lives and dies and is composed and decomposes, and God is eternal. So we are made in the image of God in the sense that we are spiritual beings and we have the capacity, we have the unique and rare capacity to make choices in our lives. You know, most of the animal kingdom and the mineral kingdom and the vegetable kingdom, these kingdoms don't make choices. They simply exist according to instinct, and they exist according to what has been passed on to them. But we as human beings are made in the image of God, and we have the ability to make choices. Now, what do we need to make choices? Think about it. If you walk into a room and there's no light in the room, there's just no light whatsoever, how can you go into that room and make a choice, and make a choice to do something? You can't walk into that room and make a choice. Very well. Same difference if you walked into that room and it was just filled with a ball of light. You would be blinded by that light. What we need to make choices is contrast. We need both light and darkness. We need the ability to choose to make a bad choice, light and darkness, in order to have the capacity to make choices. And that means that we need light and darkness, because we as physical beings can only perceive things through this contrast of material. And that is our purpose. That's why we go through this particular plane of existence, so that we can make our choices for ourselves. And through our choices, we can bring life to this world, we can grow closer to God, we can develop as spiritual beings, and that will advance us in the next world. Or through our choices, we can not do those things and become darkened, I think, spirits, but we would continue to exist. In the context of my new death experience in the life review, one of the things that I went through was re-experiencing. As a child, I had rheumatic fever, and that left me with kidney problems. It left me with, I was in a coma for a long time, and I had a lot of pain and suffering as a result of that. And in the context of the near-death experience, I looked back on that as a very great and wonderful opportunity. I didn't look back at a sick child and think what a tragedy that was, but from a spiritual perspective, I looked back and saw that that was a wonderful opportunity, because only when I was suffering could I choose to, you know, really be kind and help my mother by not burdening her with my pain as much as, you know, I could. I could choose then to be patient and to deal with my illness. I could choose to be loving despite the pain. And those are choices that are very meaningful. But we can't make those choices. We can't be a hero without conflict. You know, we can't be a light in this world without some darkness. And we have to make our choices on this physical plane of existence. I'm sorry, have I found the just, and who are they? Well, huh? Sorry? No, I was looking for it. Have I found the just and who are they? To me, yes, I have found the just. To me, God promised this world a new teaching in a new time in all of our prophecies. He promised us this. I know there were Cherokee prophecies that dealt with a new race of man. There are biblical prophecies. There are prophecies in all the writings, in the Quran, in the Buddha, I'm sorry, in the Buddhist writings. And to me, these promises have been fulfilled in the Baha'i faith, but that's a choice that I made, and that's a choice that we in the world can either make or we cannot make. But it's a choice of tremendous import. And it's a choice that only we as individuals can make for ourselves. You know, it's something that we Baha'is believe that the first principle of our faith is independent investigation of truth. So it's our responsibility to investigate for ourselves whether or not this is true or this is not true. When I had the first dream of the Blessed Beauty, I had gone to a fireside that night, and I was 13, and I had come home, and I walked in the door. I had to come home early because I was 13, and my mother expected me by 10. I walked in the door of my house, and I was on fire because I had been looking. I had been looking for the answer to the world because I knew that God does not abandon his people, that we love God, and when we love God, the love of God reaches us. And I knew that God would not leave a world in such turmoil, with no hope, with nuclear weapons, with tremendous potential for ecological destruction, that he would not leave the world without some kind of guidance. He covenanted with us to give us some kind of guidance. And I was overjoyed when I went to my first Baha'i fireside. I really thought there was only 10 Baha'is in the world. I thought that was it. But I went to my first Baha'i fireside and I said, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. I've been praying for this, that this is the promise. And I came home and I told my mother. I said, Mother, I'm so happy. We are Baha'i. I said, this is what you've taught me all my life, that there's one mankind and that there's one God and that God gives us guidance just as we give our children progressively as they grow. I very much believe that God loves us and God would not abandon us without some kind of answers. And I saw that political systems and individuals could come up with a little bit of an answer, but not enough of the answer. We needed a way to bring about a new civilization of mankind and a new awakening of the hearts of man so that we could exist the way that we truly could. And anyway, I walked into my house and I told my mother, well, Mother, this is it. This is what you've always taught me. We are Baha'is. And my mother said, you can't be a Baha'i because if you become a Baha'i, you will be denying Christ. And I said, but Mother, I love Christ. I would never deny Christ. I'd rather die than deny Christ. But I believe very strongly that this is the truth for now. And I believe that somehow I love both and there's a solution. And at the Baha'i fireside, the man had said, consider this and make your choice. You know, he had said, what is that biblical quote? Seek and ye shall find. So he said, if you have faith that God will assist you, you will be able to make a decision. Well, I was terrified. I was just terrified because I felt that this is it. I was very much in love with whatever this Baha'i faith was, and I didn't know very much at that time. And very much in love with Christ. I could never deny Christ in my life. So I went home, and that was the night. I discussed this with my mother, and I left her in tears, and I went back to my room, and I read the Bible, and I was looking up prophecies, and I was reading this little book, The Hidden Words of Baha'u'llah, and I read one, and I said, true, absolutely true. And then I read the other one, and I said, true, absolutely true. And this went on until the wee hours of the morning, and finally, exhausted, I just fell on the floor, and I said, God, you've got to help me. I can't live like this. You know, I can't live denying Christ, and I can't live denying this, because I feel such an attraction to the beauty in this. And so I simply laid it in God's hands with prayer, and that's when I had the dream of the Blessed Beauty. I did not know where the Blessed Beauty was. And I didn't understand how the Blessed Beauty could be an individual who was distinct from Christ and yet the same as Christ, one and the same. So we Baha'is believe in progressive revelation. Just like the sun comes up every day and it's a new day, it's the same sun, but it's a new day. One day it comes up, it's a Monday. Another day it comes up, it's a Tuesday. So we Baha'is believe that God sends us these manifestations of Himself to give us guidance. And that's why I believe that Baha'u'llah is the promised one and that the just are the Baha'is. Baha'u'llah in his writings addresses the Baha'is as the just. If you give me just a moment, I'll find the quote. In the dreams, Baha'u'llah, speaking to the Baha'is, says, O people of justice, be as brilliant as the light, as splendid as the fire that blazed in the burning bush. The brightness of the fire of your love will no doubt fuse and unify the contending peoples and kindreds of the earth, whilst the fierceness of the flame of enmity and hatred cannot result in but strife and ruin. So to me, this was how I would join the people of justice, was to become a Baha'i and recognize Baha'u'llah, which means the glory of God in this day and age. Is that an easy decision? Think about it. Think about the people who followed Christ in the early days. Was that easy? Do you think that was popular? Do you think that the Pharisees agreed with that during the first, years of the revelation? People had to have courage, and it was very difficult. But it had great meaning. Anyway, what do I think happens to people who have committed heinous crimes in the afterlife? Well, I think that... All I can say, if I had committed anything heinous and gone through that life review and gone through the re-experiencing of each individual's effects, I would have had to, if I had murdered someone brutally, I would have had to experience that murder myself. And I would have experienced that mother's grief. And I would have experienced the brother's grief. And I would have experienced the turmoil that resulted in the community, and I would have experienced all of these things. And that, to me, knowing if I had been responsible for something like that, I can't think of a greater torment than to truly be aware of something terrible that one has committed in this life. Washington. Do I feel that my IQ was raised considerably? I don't know. No, I don't think my IQ was raised considerably. I think that what happened was, and this does happen, that in these experiences, one can be given knowledge in a very short period of time, a very great amount of knowledge. I think it took me years to put it together. I think it'll take me the rest of my lifetime to deal with it. I think my IQ was raised considerably. No, I think, you know, I think I had some problems afterwards. I did have some brain damage as a result of that. So, did not affect my IQ because I went on to UCLA and what afterwards, but I did have to struggle with that. Okay, what do you think happens to people? Oh, I'm sorry. Can a person retain a connection to a loved one who has passed on? Yes. That's because one thing I would really want to communicate to you is that we are not physical beings. Obviously, we are physical beings. I mean, I have a body up here, and I have problems with this body sometimes, like we all do. But our true reality is a spiritual reality. And that's the reason I travel and do these talks, is I want to maybe communicate that to people, that our true reality is a spiritual reality. And therefore, if it's a spiritual reality, it does not abide by the same laws that physical life, that we experience in physical life. And separation is something that requires time and space. So we can retain our connection to a loved one that has passed on, especially when we remember those loved ones in prayer. And we remember those loved ones in loving and good and philanthropic acts done in their name, that reestablishes our connection to those individuals. Okay. Well, I think 4:45 here. Is there anyone who had another question they wish to ask? Oh! Joseph asked me, he says he wants to know what kind of work those people in the next world were doing. Well, they were learning, and they were very much involved in this world. They were very concerned with the state of this world and with the people that they loved here, and with our growth process on moving us through our stages of development. So their work was to learn and to pray for us and to influence this world in a positive manner. Baha'is believe that the souls of those good people who have passed on in the next world are like leaven to bread, just as flour and water and eggs will not rise on its own. It needs leaven to cause the bread to rise. So we as people need leavening from those loved ones and from those good souls in the next world. And we are ever connected, although we may not be aware of our connection physically. We may not be aware that you can walk over and touch this person. We Baha'is believe that we do touch that person by our prayers and by our actions for mankind in their name. Okay. Is there any other burning questions that... Go ahead. In my experience, yeah. No. Yeah. the people in the other world. It wasn't a matter of talking. It was like a state of being with that person, of feeling. Oh, the people who were in the hospital, no, nobody saw any other spirits around or whatnot. But sometimes in the eye of a person's heart or spirit is open, they may see things. But we have to, I think, be careful not to delude ourselves. I think we just, the best thing is to pray and to have faith that we are connected and we are not alone. Yes, she's a lady.
What about the person who has a long-term illness, and physically they remain alive here on Earth,
mm-hmm.
but their spirit is in a state of limbo?
Mm-hmm. This is a very real question for me, because after I had this near-death experience, I had become a universal reactor. In other words, I could react to everything and to anything, and my brain began to swell as a result of these allergies, and I began to lose my faculties. And I knew that I was having trouble seeing, and I was having trouble walking, and my balance was off, and I was phasing in and out of normal consciousness. And this was a very frightening thing, to consider myself being an individual who would perhaps turn into a vegetable. But I also knew very much that life has purpose and that life is sacred, whatever the stage of that life. And I turned to my Baha'i writings at a point when I could see, and this was something that came and went. And in our writings it tells us that the soul of man is above any infirmities of body or mind. In other words, the soul of man exists and can and is exalted above illness and debilitation, and all things physical. If we have to think about it in an allegory, when this is something else in our writings, says that when a cloud covers the sun and we don't feel the effects of the sun in our world, does that mean that the sun has gone out? When a person can no longer communicate or can no longer function or can no longer do things that perhaps they could do before, does that mean that the true reality of that person ceases to exist? Absolutely not. No more so than the sun goes dark when a cloud covers its light. So our soul is exalted above the physical things that we experience in this world. I know I found that a tremendous comfort, knowing that, you know, I might not always be capable of communicating and doing things in this world. Yeah, I might become, quote-unquote, a vegetable. But whatever my state, if I have faith, and if I have love of God, and if I have, you know, done good things in this life, then my soul will progress. Yeah, the striped shirt.
I wanted to ask two questions. One, concept of reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
The next question is, during your near-death experience, did you have any experience like maybe that your spirit had lived before in any way?
Maybe you'd like to answer yes and no. No, I felt that I was connected with all humanity throughout time. So in other words, I could be one, I could be unified with a kindred soul who had existed, you know, thousands of years before. But time didn't necessarily separate us. And I could be so close to that person that I could feel things just like they felt them and were aware of them, their own feelings, but yet I was still a distinct individual. So in that sense, I could experience and be aware of other beings who had existed in other times and feel them very intently, just as if they were my own self, and yet have them not be myself. Do you understand? I believed in the possibility of reincarnation before I had the experience. After the experience, I was left with a feeling that, not a feeling, a very strong conviction that this life is very precious, that, you know, what we have, this is it, that this is the time we have to make our choices, that each of us has a purpose on its plane of existence, but that each of us is also connected to all humanity throughout all time, that we are one. And if we are one people, then there are ways that we can, you know, be close spiritually, that perhaps some people interpret as reincarnation. For me, after the experience, I just felt that we are given this one opportunity, and that is it. Okay, one more question.
Do you place any significance on hearing someone call your name when you're alone?
When I'm alone? I don't understand the question. You mean, do you feel like perhaps maybe a spirit called you?
Yes.
Uh-huh. I have to admit I've had that happen. Perhaps in the middle of the night I've heard my father's voice call out to me. But I think that it's just a sign of our connection with those who love us. Maybe it's not someone that we know, as I was talking to this man earlier. Maybe it's not someone that we've actually physically known in our lifetime, but it's someone who's akin to us, who we have an affinity for, who we have a spiritual similarity to, who can perhaps call out to us. And at times, we, I think, do become aware of that, but it's not something that we can count on. Like, we know we can be aware of this table whenever we put our hand on it. Okay, Joseph is informing me it's time for us to close. I would like to thank you all for coming this afternoon, and I want you to know that this has been a great, you know, blessing and bounty for me, and I appreciate all the work that so many of you have done to bring this about, and I appreciate your presence. There's one short thing that I'd like to read to you. It is one of my favorite quotes from the Baha'i writings, and that's the one thing that I think is the most important about the near-death experience, is to remember the reality of our spirit and the reality of spiritual qualities such as love and kindness and mercy and justice, and for us to be aware that we are loved. Know thou of a certainty that love is the secret of God's holy dispensation, the manifestation of heaven's kindly light, the Holy Spirit's eternal breath, that is the vital bond inherent in the realities of things. Love is the light, the living link that uniteth God with man. Love is the most great law, the unique power that bindeth together the diverse elements of this material world, the supreme magnetic force that directeth the movements of the spheres in the celestial realms. Love revealeth with unfailing and limitless power the mysteries latent in the universe. Love is the spirit of life unto the adorned body of mankind, the establisher of true civilization in this mortal world, and the shadow of imperishable glory upon every high-aiming race and nation. Whatsoever people is graciously favored therewith by God, its name shall surely be magnified and extolled in the concourse on high. And whatsoever people turneth its heart away from this divine love, the revelation of the All-Merciful shall err grievously, shall fall into despair and be utterly destroyed. strive to become the manifestations of the love of God, the lamps of divine guidance shining amongst the kindreds of the earth, and the light of love and concord. All hail to the reviewers of this glorious life.